Well, good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. So nice to have you on this 20th day of November. It is a Thursday, and we have all kinds of things to talk about, and we will do exactly that this morning. Let me introduce the group to you. A reminder, you can always be a part of our program. All you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We can't get to every letter. We just can't. And quite frankly, a lot of the letters are similar. So we try to get the mood of the room is the best way I could describe it. And so if we get 10 letters and they're all similar, we pick one or two that kind of personify the thought involved. But we appreciate all of your letters, and we thank you. And if they're brief and to the point and don't have links or abbreviations, and you actually proofread them and they have verbs and stuff, we're ready to go, and we would love to include them in our program. panel@wamc.org. Let me introduce the group to you this morning. Public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois is here. Good morning, Teresa. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning. I'm doing well. I would like to note, I try to do a little this day in history. It would be the 100th birthday of Robert F. Kennedy. And
really?
So a little homework for folks. I recommend everybody read his Ripple of Hope speech given in Cape Town, South Africa. And also listen to his read his Ripple of Hope speech. But also listen to his remarks in Indianapolis on the night that Martin Luther King was killed. Some really poignant and important history there. But in the Ripple of Hope speech, he talks about the youth of South Africa and the world. And we saw what happens when youth get involved, young people get involved in the recent election, where they came out in record numbers, engaged in record numbers, and make a difference. And all these years later, after his speech, and it was 1966, June 6th.
I'm not making light of this at all, but man, I'll take a ripple of hope anytime, right?
Yeah.
If you can't have a full wave, a ripple sounds pretty
well,
good to me.
Well, that was the point of his speech. Each one, creates a ripple, and it comes together as a much more. So, anyway.
Well, good to know. Thank you very much.
Little history point.
I get homework.
There's always homework.
I love homework.
Homework, a little homework.
Fantastic.
I never think of a better word for that opportunity.
Well, no, that's good. I think homework is good.
I recommend it.
Teresa, thank you very much for being here. We welcome Senior Fellow for Health Policy at the Empire Center for Public Policy, Bill Hammond, is with us. Good morning.
Good morning.
Bill, how are you?
Very pleased to be here.
Always wonderful to have you on the program. We enjoy it. We also love having Emily Honan with us, grants analyst based in Albany. Good morning, Emily. How are you?
Good morning. I am doing better than usual. The news isn't quite as dystopian and apocalyptic as I'm used to. We're getting a few ripples of hope, going on. I'm in a better mood than I usually am. I usually just say I'm angry.
All right. Well, don't.
With a big smile.
Don't get too used to it, but we'll
hope
for
not
it.
Good.
Yeah, we'll
yeah,
hope.
I got some
we'll
things for you to consider. That'll harsh your mellow.
Oh, by the time you leave with Teresa, you'll be right back where you were. Good morning, all. Thank you for being with us. It's an honor to have you with us and to have you join us on this Thursday morning as we wade through the many stories that we have to discuss this morning. So, of course, where do we want to begin? Let's talk about the Comey case. I find this to be interesting. We've touched on this over the last couple of days, but yesterday, this was fairly extraordinary. Although we always say this is extraordinary, and then it only lasts for about a week before something more extraordinary happens. But anyway, a federal judge grilled the prosecutors pursuing charges against James Comey, the former FBI director, on Wednesday, interrogating them with a series of questions that underscored irregularities in the case, including that the full grand jury did not see the indictment it was supposed to have approved. Something you should probably have done. The questioning by the judge, Michael Nachmanoff, took place at an excruciatingly awkward hearing in federal district court in Alexandria, Virginia. I am one who enjoys the excruciatingly awkward not when I'm a part of it, but to watch it and view it and to
it was cringe comedy.
Yeah, right? That's always fun. That was nominally held to consider the narrow issue of whether the charges against Mr. Comey had been filed as an act of vindictive retribution by President Trump. But the judge peppered prosecutors with questions on a range of topics, including Mr. Trump's own statements about wanting Mr. Comey to be indicted, and an earlier decision by career members of the U.S. Attorney's Office in Alexandria to forego bringing charges. In one remarkable moment, the judge posed some of his questions directly to Lindsey Halligan, the U.S. attorney handpicked by Mr. Trump to bring the case, quizzing her on how she had presented it to the grand jury. Just this week, that subject led another judge involved in the case to suggest that she may have engaged in prosecutorial misconduct. Judge Nachmanoff's inquiries were extraordinary by almost any measure, but the answers prosecutors gave him in return were even more so. At one point, Ms. Halligan admitted that she had never shown the second and final version of the Comey indictment to the full grand jury before the foreperson signed the charging document. Mr. Comey's lawyers immediately seized on that irregularity, calling it another reason to dismiss the case entirely. So how does that happen? Can someone tell me how that happens?
When someone's extremely unqualified for the job?
No, but it would be. I'm not arguing your point. But the foreperson still signed the charging document. But would they? Isn't it someone's job to make sure that the full indictment was seen by the grand jury?
So this whole process has been an exercise in ignoring rules and norms. I mean, it started with the president making a social media post. It may have been accidental. Maybe he meant it to be a direct message. But he made a social media post.
To Pam Bondi.
To the attorney general, telling her whom to prosecute and why, and making clear that it was the reason he wanted these people prosecuted is because they were his enemies, his political critics and rivals and antagonists. And that blows up the whole concept of how the Justice Department is supposed to work, right? It's supposed to be practicing justice, not carrying out the president's vendettas. Everything that follows after that seems trivial in comparison. And the fact, they blew past all of the norms. They have an unqualified person who may not even be legally appointed as the U.S. attorney. She walks into the grand jury room with this a very flimsy, bogus case. And the fact that she didn't even dot the I's and cross the T's is just icing on the cake. But what I give both the lawyers and the judge credit, because I find it all, kind of ridiculous and excruciatingly cringeworthy and all that stuff. But they have to take it seriously. They have to go through
right. The
nuts and bolts of what's supposed to happen, what actually happened, and they have to lay it all out. That's what this hearing was. The benefit of this hearing is that it's documenting every single wrong step that got taken. And the lawyer even said at one point, look, judge, this is the question of whether somebody's going to stand up to what this president is doing. He said that, he made it big, and I think appropriately so. So I don't think Trump actually cares if Comey is convicted. There's a jokey saying in the criminal justice world, you can beat the rap but not the ride, which means the process is the punishment. Comey has to, live under this threat of being imprisoned. He has to spend money on lawyers. I mean, I'm assuming he's spending money. Maybe he's getting pro bono help. He has to go through all that, even if he's ultimately acquitted. But the so maybe Trump doesn't care. So the question is, will this backfire on him? Will this lead to a judge taking a stand, issuing a ruling, doing something that really lays down the law?
Yesterday, at just one more part of this, at another point, one of Ms. Halligan's subordinates, Tyler Lemons, acknowledged that someone in the Deputy Attorney General's office had instructed him not to discuss in open court whether his prosecutors had or had not written a memo laying out their reasons for not bringing charges, because that was privileged information. In the end, Mr. Lemons, appearing unnerved under questioning, confessed that the prosecutors who had previously handled the case had indeed written a draft of a memo declining prosecution. The spectacle, which played out over nearly 90 minutes of tense courtroom colloquy, is that right? Colloquy?
Colloquy.
Colloquy. Thank you. Drove home just how slapdash the prosecution of Mr. Comey appeared to have been from its inception. Judge Nachmanoff declined to issue a ruling from the bench on Mr. Comey's claims that the case was brought vindictively, but he appeared to be leaning in that direction. Given the other revelations of the day, he could now have more reasons to throw out the charges. Teresa.
So, not a lawyer, I'm not, but it does seem like this case is going to go away sooner rather than later. And I strongly agree with Bill's assessment that I don't think the Trump administration cares if they win or lose. It's the process that they're after. They've gotten the headlines. They've gotten the distraction. They've gotten Comey to pay a financial price for this. And they have lined up a whole lot of others to, you know, run through the same process. So they'll just go from one to the other. But I think the bigger question that we have to ask is what's the cost of this? What's the financial cost to taxpayers is one thing. But more importantly, what's the opportunity cost of all of these vengeance cases? And it's clearly, you know, it's a waste of our tax dollars. It's a waste of resources. But it's more concerning. It's the misuse of the Justice Department. And because when they're focusing on this case or these kinds of cases, what are they not focusing on, right? And what's not being done when justice personnel are being shifted away from the day-to-day work that they had been doing to things like the Trump-Vance deportation campaign and all of these other peripheral issues? What's happening with the essentially gutting of the Justice Department and the AG's office and FBI? There's been report after report, but there was a major piece in the Sunday New York Times Magazine section about the troubling hollowing out of the Justice Department. And I think that's the lens at which we should look at these kinds of stories in terms of what is not happening to protect the American people while this vengeance campaign is underway. You know, some of the findings in that New York Times report were pretty deeply concerning. 200 career attorneys have been fired. Thousands more have resigned. And then what you get is these people who are coming in who just don't have the experience. And you know, what's the I was trying to see here a list of the kinds of work that they're not doing. But I think that's, besides the very bad precedent that this attack against Comey and the others offers, I think we have to realize what's the bigger cost. The other thing I'd like to say is, in all of this, the Trump administration frames this as his enemies. And I've said it before, I'm going to say it again. I think we have to not reiterate that language. The reporters reiterate it all the time. And these are people that they're attacking. These are people that they... I just think we have to not fall into using that word, because that's not why Comey went after him. It's because of actions that Trump and his administration took, and we can't fall into that using their enemy's language.
I understand the point, but to Trump, it's his enemies list.
But that's a that is miscommunication. That is falling into his to repeat that.
No, I understand, but it's not like it's not true. Like, I mean, I feel
like maybe targets his hit list almost. It's almost like a one-sided thing. It's like to him, they're his mortal nemesis, but to them, it's like it's this annoying guy.
But that's a communications tool he uses. He does things that appear to be against the law.
Yeah.
And if people try to hold him accountable for doing things that appear to be against the law, he labels them enemies, or he labels the reporters incompetent or stupid or piggy. And I just think that there needs to be a little better discipline. It's maybe a nuanced point, but I really feel it's important to not fall into using his language, because it's a part of his disinformation campaign. And we should try not to be part of his disinformation campaign. I mean, I hear myself doing it all the time and try to stop myself. But I just think we need to call it out, just like the lawyers called out the reasons they were being so meticulous. And Bill, I'm glad that you laid those out. You know, that they called out the reasons they were being so meticulous was because this is not normal. This is not proper. We shouldn't be doing this, right? And the way we're going to change this is not falling into the use of his language and calling out, the way you pointed out, the details of how the Comey lawyers pointed out.
I want to hear from Emily. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll go to Emily. We'll continue this conversation, and we'll welcome your letter. It's panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. And we welcome you as always. Before we do that, we will go over to a break that will include news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We are talking about the Comey indictment and the fact that Lindsey Halligan, who is handling this case for the Trump administration and the Justice Department, admitted the grand jury never saw the final Comey indictment. And we are talking about that and such cases that are coming out of the DOJ in this administration. Emily.
Yeah, I just think it's a microcosm of the entire Trump administration. I mean, you have ridiculously unqualified people doing these silly things to support the man with the thinnest skin I've ever seen. You know, everything is just a vanity project for him. He's doing it, as Teresa said, at the expense of the American people. And it's amazing that, you know, nothing will happen to them because of this. I mean, the greatest possible outcome, I believe, is that, you know, Trump is somehow humiliated because of this, because of all the mistakes that have been rightfully called out by the by Comey's attorneys and the judge. But I mean, nothing's going to happen. Like, nothing's going to happen because he broke the law, because he went through all these, you know, shortcuts. I mean, it's just going to go on and on. If you try to tell this to his supporters, they won't care. If you try to use it against him, he won't care. And it will just not have any impact on anything, except for, you know, we all have to sit through this kangaroo court while Comey's lawyers and the judge have to go through the due process of actually doing their jobs, while Trump and his side just do whatever they want and don't care. And they'll never suffer any consequences for it. As you said, the Justice Department is being gutted. People are being forced out of their jobs. I mean, some people are resigning because they cannot work in an atmosphere like this, but people are being forced out. I mean, I read an article the other day about one of the FBI former FBI worker who's being fired very clearly because he had a pride flag at his desk.
Yes.
And that's just one case. And it will take months and months to wind its way through. There's obviously so many other cases like that that, you know, people don't always have the resources to bring a huge case like that. But it's just all very, very stark and on display, as I've said before, just kind of this very obvious display of fascism and totalitarianism. I mean, here you have what's essentially a dictator with his political... Anyone who dares to question him is immediately, you know, subject to the boot of the law.
Right.
So there's the monetary cost of this. There's the opportunity cost of the Justice Department not doing its real job. But the thing that's scariest to me is what's being done to the Justice Department,
yes,
to the institution, to the way it's supposed to operate. And I'm not sure, it'll take a long time for the department to recover its reputation after this. It's also, it's just dangerous. If the president can use the law enforcement branch of the government as a weapon against mm-hmm. his political rivals, against his antagonists, that's just dangerous. It's banana republic stuff. It's verging on fascism. Like that's, and so I guess the question for me is, there are two institutions who could potentially stand in Trump's way at some point, and that's the Congress who can impeach him, and the Supreme Court who can block his worst actions. So far, both of them have been giving him way too much leeway. But at some point, he's going to do something that pushes people too far. And the question is how far they'll let him go. And I think a case like this, if it makes it to the Supreme Court, I have to think that it'll be a 9-0 ruling in favor of Comey. But maybe it's wishful thinking on my part. But one of these offenses against not just norms, but like the entire constitutional system is going to get to the Supreme Court and they're going to have to lay down the law. It'll be a crisis. I guess the idealist in me is holding out hope that someone will eventually draw a line.
Well, I think in this case, the judge, as you had pointed out earlier, is trying to draw or make crystal clear the norm breaking that's happening here and holding them accountable for their improper actions. And I do, going back to this Sunday New York Times piece, you know, those lawyers describe being asked to, quote, drop cases for political reasons, to find evidence for flimsy investigations, and take positions in court that they thought had no legitimate basis. And that just reinforces what you're saying, Bill, in terms of the kinds of norm breaking that's happening. But one of the things that worries me is that with all of these lawyers being driven out, in some cases, offices are being dismantled. But in other cases, this is as part of Project 2025. Mm-hmm. They're bringing in their own people.
Oh, yeah.
And many are novices. Now, in the Comey case, he has the best of the best legal team. I mean, he has just some amazing...
Former Solicitor General.
Right. Some extraordinary legal talent are on this case. But what about the average person who is up against some of these folks who may not have the skills and the talent and may not be following the norms and may be caught up in the system because of that? And I presume that that's happening all over the country right now as new people with lack of experience are being brought in. And that's kind of a hidden cost. And I think a light needs to be shown on that. There needs to be more light, more attention about what's being dismantled at the Justice Department. As I say, what's not being looked into, but also when they bring in people that don't have the skills for the job and have this really political and vengeance focus, what's the impact on others who are going through the system? It's deeply disturbing.
Let's go to a couple of letters that we got from our listeners, and we welcome you as well. Trump loved Comey just before the 2016 election when then FBI Director Comey said they had found more Hillary Clinton emails, says John. The email showed nothing against Hillary, but her polls dropped and Trump won the election.
That's one of the ironies in terms of Trump's attacks on Comey. And let's also remember that it went beyond him to go after and drive out Comey's daughter, and who was one of the chief investigators on the Epstein case as well. And so, you know, he's taking a pretty broad swath at the family.
So that letter writer was alluding to, like, Comey's role in investigating Hillary Clinton in 2016, right?
Yes.
There was a moment during that investigation when the attorney general at that time, and I had to look up her name, Loretta Lynch, she, for whatever reason, decided to meet the president and Mrs. Clinton when they landed at an airport. It may have, like, I think it may have been some kind of coincidence. At least that was the story.
They both were.
But that was like a huge scandal.
Right.
Just the fact that the attorney general was meeting with the president and the first lady in the middle of an investigation involving the first lady. It was just improper that there should be any contact between the attorney general and the White House in that context. Pam Bondi is at the White House all the time, and she's apparently taking his direction via tweet or, you know, whatever Truth Social is called. So we're so far beyond where we were just 9 years ago. That's something that struck me.
We got this letter from Jeff, who says, Teresa's exactly right. Allowing Trump to frame the narrative causes us to slip into his false narrative. This is why we so often feel we are through the looking glass. This is a textbook authoritarian trick. See Hannah Arendt. We are starting to chip away at the lie. See the recent wins in the court and at the polls. We must not stop. That from Jeff.
Thank you, Jeff. You framed it better than I could. I appreciate that.
Kathleen writes, I don't understand all this stuff with Comey. If the case is thrown out, why aren't his attorney costs paid for by the prosecution? They lost. Then
that's a flaw in our justice system generally. Yeah. That predates Trump.
Trump's administration has kind of laid bare the cruelty inherent in the very structure of the government, I think. And we're all just realizing, oh, no. If we have someone who doesn't care about anything in charge, there's nothing anyone can do to stop him. And we've just now realized that.
Dave writes, when America put Trump back in office, we won the crackpot jackpot. In the case of their prosecutors, nobody who was honest and competent would take their phony revenge cases. That leaves only the dishonest or the incompetent and those who are both. The Comey case debacle is one in which their ravings have degenerated to the point that they have become their own self-parody, though still very and widely destructive. It's an interesting point, too, because this the young woman who was assigned this
Halligan
case this was her first case ever. She was a Trump lawyer. Was the first job.
She was in charge of reviewing exhibits at the Smithsonian to see if they were too woke.
Yeah.
Yes, that was the first.
Oh, it doesn't portray America well enough. It acts like we did bad things like slavery.
And that women should actually have a place at the table.
Teresa, let's not go crazy.
I know. How horrible of the Smithsonian for noting that there are African Americans, indigenous people, and women in the country.
That sounds like fake news. I don't.
Some show, I just want you to do that voice for the entire 2 hours. we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll move on to other topics. We welcome you to join us. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll continue right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We have been talking about the Jeffrey Epstein case, the ups and downs of this over the last week and a half or so. And I'm not bragging about that, but I'm just saying that's sort of where the news cycle has brought us over the last several days. Well, you know, of course, the very quick turnaround here that there was going to be a vote. The vote gained great momentum. The president, who had said that he would not support the release of the files then after it became apparent that this had gained much traction, that he was going to sign the bill and allow it to move forward to release the Epstein files. So then last night, in which I thought was comical, I don't know whether it was just me, but they seemed to be making the story about that it had been ready for the president's signature at 3, and by 6:30 he still hadn't signed it, and everybody was like, he's not gonna, and I don't know what they were waiting for, but I just, anyway, so he signed it. Like, he said he was going to sign it. He signed it. Like, okay, we're good. President Trump sought credit for the legislation. he said despite months of pressure to kill it, he said that it was all his doing. And the bill has significant exceptions that could mean many documents would stay confidential. So here we go. This is from Luke Broadwater writing for the New York Times. My apologies. Relenting to pressure from his base, President Trump on Wednesday announced on social media that he signed legislation calling on the Justice Department to release its files on the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein within 30 days. Mr. Trump's signature does not guarantee the release of all the files. The bill contains significant exceptions, including a provision protecting continuing investigations, which could mean many documents would stay confidential. And let us not forget, just last week, the president, as this was starting to gain momentum, the president, in an attempt to block it, called for more investigations to take place against Democrats who would have been communicating in some way, shape, and form with Jeffrey Epstein. In a lengthy announcement on Truth Social, Mr. Trump focused on Democrats who were connected to Mr. Epstein and said the furor over the documents was a distraction to hurt his administration. Democrats have used the Epstein issue, which affects them far more than the Republican Party, in order to try and distract from our amazing, shouty caps, victories, he said. In his post, the president sought to portray the bill's passage as the result of a directive to his party. As everyone knows, I asked Speaker of the House Mike Johnson and Senate Majority Leader John Thune to pass the bill in the House and Senate, respectively. Because of this request, the votes were almost unanimous. See what I did there? But in fact, his call for Republicans to approve the measure came only after it became clear Mr. Trump had lost a political battle on the issue. Against Mr. Trump's wishes, House Democrats and a few Republicans joined together to force a vote on the bill. And as the vote neared, other Republicans signaled that they would approve the measure. Maria Farmer, the first abuse survivor to report Mr. Epstein and his former girlfriend, Ghislaine Maxwell, to law enforcement in 1996, hailed the development. Quote, after being left in the dark for decades, having my repeated calls for transparency and action ignored, and living through nearly five administrations that turned a blind eye to this enormous travesty of justice, Congress finally listened to survivors, she said yesterday. The White House has maintained that it has already made public tens of thousands of pages of documents tied to the Epstein investigation, and nothing will satisfy Mr. Trump's critics. I do want to just point out, I think most of you, know, that as during the campaign, even though the president has said that it's House Democrats who are doing this and saying that the Democrats just want to damage the Republican Party in order to try to distract from the, quote, amazing victories. It was during the campaign where Donald Trump, as a candidate, night after night on the campaign trail, said we should release the Epstein files. So finally, that campaign promise has been realized.
There's no guarantee that that these files are going to settle anything.
No,
they're not even going to release all of them, it's not going to happen. The reason that he's so pro this is because he knows that they're not actually going to release anything that actually matters. But I think that this is just a really good kind of encapsulation of just how much not only how willing he is to just blatantly lie. There's evidence of him saying the exact opposite, and then he'll say, "I never said that," to your face. It's like textbook 1984. And what's even more astounding to me is the fact that his supporters are okay with that. I mean, you can just say, "Hey, look, here's Trump completely lying," and then turning around and they'll be like, "Well, Joe Biden was creepy," and that's somehow their gotcha. Like, oh. Anyway, sorry, that was more complaining, but it's
there's a fine line between sharp political commentary and complaining.
Complaining,
I must say.
Getting that out there. But I also think that it's interesting because there was kind of a little hint in the news cycle that was going on last week. I'm not sure if it made it into major media outlets, but there were a lot of things said about Trump in Jeffrey Epstein's emails that were recently released. And I think the funniest one was that allegedly he had been so distracted by the young girls bathing in the pool that he walked into a glass door and like nose first and left an imprint. And I almost wonder if he's suddenly changed his mind because he thinks that it will somehow vindicate him of all the other things that were said in these emails. And I do think it's interesting that now, I mean, there's no way to prove what Jeffrey Epstein is saying in these emails about Trump. But I think it's interesting that now his modus operandi of lies, it just straight up lies, is being used against him. I mean, you can say whatever he wants. Like Jeffrey Epstein said this about Trump in his emails, and now we can just run with that and do whatever we want.
The I'm sorry, I lost my.
Aw.
So on the Epstein situation,
we have another hour for you to find it. By the way,
I'll talk a bit while you can, so you can remember. Did you remember?
Not yet.
Okay, let me know when you do. No, it happens to me all the time. I would like.
There you go.
I would like Bill to go ahead.
So this is a case where his supporters are not buying his rhetoric.
Good point.
They're the ones who forced this issue. They're the ones, like the Republicans in Congress were like rallying to this cause, not because they wanted to, not because the president wanted them to, but because Trump's base wanted them to. And so it's like a unique moment in this not very old administration that the Congress. This was a vote in defiance of the president. He's trying to make it look like he wanted them to do it, but it was in defiance of what he wanted. And he's now coming up with a new strategy where, maybe they can't release the files because there are these pending investigations or something like that, or maybe he won't release all of the files. I think all of those things are going to blow up in his face because his base wants the files out, for better or for worse.
But don't you think that the November 4th vote, the overwhelming votes around the country, gave some of his, particularly the more moderate Republicans in the House and Senate, a spine on this issue?
Yeah, well, but also the...
In addition to his core base being ginned up about it for years.
Well, and also there was a woman elected, was it from Arizona or New Mexico?
Yes.
She was the deciding signature on the discharge petition. So this is the fact that it was almost unanimous, it just shows what he's up against, and that this absolutely was not something he wanted.
Well, and
he wanted to use it as an issue when he was on the campaign trail, but then he was like, no. We are not going to release these files. And he went on social media and said, this is ridiculous. Why should we release the files? It's This was a, you know, a, just a complete defeat for him, and it's a rare one, especially in Congress.
I'm going to hold you there, Teresa. We're just going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back after this break in news with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. Bill Hammond is here, Emily Honan and Teresa Bourgeois. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We're talking about the Epstein files and the president's signing of the bill and the ultimate question of what happens now with the Justice Department and how much will we actually learn as a result of how many of these files are released and what we get out of them. Teresa Bourgeois.
So I would like to propose something that's not going to happen, but I'd like to propose it anyway, which is that there be a moratorium on discussing who the political winners and losers are in this case, and instead focus on the actual issue of trafficking and the implications of that, and then what's, you know, sort of, it's not just what's in the emails that the Justice Department has, but also this is a classic, it appears to me to be a classic case of follow the money. And one of the things that I did hear yesterday that the House Investigation Committee is doing is subpoenaing some of the financial records. I heard an interview with Jamie Dimon from J.P. Morgan Chase recently, where he was asked, and he said they kept Epstein on for much longer than they should have as a client until they eventually did debank him. But he was clear to note that they had repeatedly sent in, filed, what do they call them, warnings, suspicious activity reports. And so because of the money that was moving through his accounts. And so it seems to me you'd want to look at those suspicious activity reports. But back to the issue of trafficking, I think it's important to note that the Trump administration has had a whole range of budget cuts that affect the resources and supports for victims of human trafficking and for violence against women and for a whole series of supports that really address this issue. The State Department has a there was something called the Trafficking Victims Protection Act of 2000. They mandated the State Department have an office that focused solely on combating human trafficking, both in the U.S. and abroad. And that has essentially been dismantled. The Department of Justice, I was reading a report, the Department of Justice, the Council on Criminal Justice, details the impact of the Trump administration's, and I'm quoting here, abruptly stopping and pulling back U.S. Department of Justice grants on a range of programs, including violence reduction, policing, prosecution, victim services, juvenile justice, child protections, substance abuse, mental health, corrections, reentry, justice system enhancements, research and evaluation, and included in these are a range of programs that address this issue of trafficking, particularly with underage girls. And so it seems to me it would be very helpful right now to have much more attention given to the issue that these victims, these survivors, are trying to draw attention to, both their own circumstances and the ongoing circumstances now. And I think that we could use a little less talk about the winners and losers among politicians and a little more focus on the victims in the Epstein case and other victims of trafficking.
Absolutely. There is a wonderful, I think she's someone that I enjoy reading, but Jennifer Weiner is a novelist who writes about gender and culture. She has an opinion piece in the New York Times that I believe went in yesterday about exactly this. Let's stop talking about the men who are at the center of this and whose livelihoods are at stake, ... and let us start talking about the actual issue that allows this to happen, and to the victims and who were impacted and affected, and what the long-term impacts of that are, and how they have to tell their story 5 billion times compared to the one allegation or the one statement that someone or an email of someone who is accused of writing an email and then goes away. There's a lot of I read this piece last night, and so you're touching on something, and I've been, like, my brain's been swimming about this. But I mean, please do not think I'm a Larry Summers fan. Not at all. Never.
He lost me when he attacked women on STEM issues. That, you know, women can't anyway.
Right. Not a fan. However, if you're Larry Summers, you're giving up everything right now, and the. It's like, okay, well, what about the president? What about these other people?
Larry Summers has a sense of shame.
Right.
Yeah. Yes.
Let's be clear. Larry Summers should step back. Let's be clear.
Absolutely.
But should Trump.
No, exactly.
But no one can make him do that. And
exactly.
He will never do that.
And there's nothing in the whole Larry Summers saga that has anything to do with underage women or trafficking.
No, it's writing emails. Although he was giving them, like, romance advice, which is just icky.
It was icky, very creepy.
We don't know if it was legal or illegal. It was icky and good that he's stepping back. But what bothers me is the focus on the political outcome of this. Who is it going to help or hurt politically?
Yeah, it's very dehumanizing.
Let's refocus it on the underlying problem with this massive power dynamic among, you know, these underage girls. And don't get me going on what Megyn Kelly said, because that was just...
Oh, my God. Oh, my... How is she allowed to be on the air? I mean...
How does she...
Well, I said this yesterday on the show too, but let me. I have to say that her words were disgusting. I don't know if any of you heard what. Not that you're expecting this not to be disgusting coming out of the mouth of Alan Dershowitz, but Alan Dershowitz. Did you see the thing about, he said, well, look, the girl was 17 years old and 10 months. Come on.
Always a good, strong argument to make.
There's like two things. I mean, trafficking is when there's money involved, right? And that doesn't have to be underage or overage. The underage issue, having, you know, sexual intercourse with somebody who's not, hasn't reached adulthood, that's a crime of a different sort.
I think we call that rape.
Well, yeah, I mean, it can be what they call statutory rape. It's a crime. That is really what the crime at the heart of the Epstein case, right? I'm not that familiar with it, but was there actual evidence of prostitution?
There's reportedly over 1,000 victims that were trafficked by these two.
Trafficked? What do you mean trafficked?
What has been described is that these were, in many cases, young people who came from challenging circumstances. And I remember there's one case where the woman's mother was a cancer patient, needed money for her treatment, and so she was pulled into, or what Ghislaine Maxwell is accused of, is grooming these young women, often in very challenging economic circumstances, to get pulled into something, or they're made promises of a career, and then they find themselves in some, you know, a horrific situation that they have to pull themselves out of, but they feel trapped. And it's a horrible, grotesque power dynamic, which is, the more I read about these stories, that's the more that I feel it's imperative that we shift the focus to the victims and to the things that happened in these situations, which are undoubtedly happening now to other people, particularly underage girls, and the systems that are in place to try to prevent that, the Trump administration is dismantling, not only to prevent it, to provide services for those who have been victims. And think about this case. It's taken these people 10 years, two or three suicides, you know, with the amazing joke. Can you remind me the name of the reporter, the Miami Herald reporter, who's written a book, who has been on this case for years? Do you remember the woman, Sally? I'm sorry that I don't remember her name.
I'm sorry, I don't either, but I'll look it up.
But yeah, but she's written a book. She has been on this case, focusing on the victims for years. But they have been trying to get attention to the substance of this and get justice. They've been through the courts. Justice has been denied in very odd ways. And so I think that attention needs to be put on not so much what are the political, you know, machinations of this for various elected officials, but what are the implications? Julia K. Brown, thank you very much, Bill. Look at her writing on this. It's been amazing. But 10 years. And I think that we need to begin to understand this thing that happens in the shadows.
Well, you want, I guess, so we were talking off the air about how this is, at some level, there is an invasion of privacy going on. I mean, some of these emails that have nothing to do with a crime, and it's hugely embarrassing for someone like Larry Summers and the other people whose emails have been exposed. But what they do is sort of open a window into this world of very wealthy, elite, powerful people, mostly men in this case, who are the way they pal around and the way they overlook each other's transgressions and wink and even joke about it.
Yeah.
It's really, like, it's disturbing that at the very highest levels of our society, not just wealthy, but also powerful, also holding positions of responsibility and you know, esteem and prestige, and yet in their private lives are engaged in really icky,
abhorrent,
you know,
illegal,
immoral,
activity.
And sometimes illegal activity. It reminds me of that scene in Diner when, like, you know, I don't even know the characters' names. Would be like, do you ever get the feeling there's something going on we don't know about? Like, that's what it feels like.
They're right,
pulling back the curtain on the. I'm sure that there are large sections of the elite in society who aren't this icky, but it's really scary to see.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I think that's what I think it is important to know that just because a person's name is referenced in the emails, it doesn't mean that they have done something illegal. And this came up. I know the White House was pushing out Hakeem Jeffries' name yesterday because he was referenced, and they were saying that he took money from, or he solicited money from Epstein long after the first court case with Epstein. And I heard him interviewed last night, and what others were describing is that Epstein got an email from one of the, I'm not even sure which campaign committee it was, but it's one of these that goes out to lots of people. You know, you complain about getting these emails all the time, soliciting money.
Yeah.
And so that is a far cry from an email directly from Jeffries to Epstein personally asking for funding. But again, I will note that by all reports, there was enormous amounts of money that was moving through this situation with Epstein. And I think that there does need to be more attention to that flow of funds.
And I feel like we should also enter into this equation. We haven't really, I don't think we've talked about it on this show, but Stacey Plaskett, the Democrat of the Virgin Islands, a non-voting member, by the way, of Congress, during House Committee on the Judiciary, and defeated the House on Tuesday, defeated a Republican attempt to censure Plaskett, a Democrat of the Virgin Islands and remover from the Intelligence Committee for exchanging text messages with convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein during a congressional hearing. Here again, holding her into account while others, I don't know. But in that case, from my understanding of what she said, was that she felt her job was to find out more information about the case. She was emailing to find out more information about the case. So I don't know, but it seems, again, to your point, just because your name is in there doesn't mean that you're automatically
guilty of something.
Guilty of something, right?
Right, right. And again, I do think that there need to be some hard questions asked of how the Trump administration was allowed to dismantle a congressionally mandated entity, this State Department program that generated, you know, thousands of cases, convictions of cases, and brought attention to sex trafficking and human trafficking in general. And, you know, why are they allowed to do that? And why are they allowed to pull back funding for congressionally mandated programs? And what's the impact on this issue? Now, they keep, in talking, you know, the part of their deportation campaign around immigrants is that they're, one of the things they talk about is we're trying to get at the trafficking issues. Well, you have tools to do that, and you've dismantled those tools, and you've pulled back that funding. And so some energy and attention, I think, needs to be paid to the broader issue.
All right. Let's move on to other topics for this Thursday morning. And again, we welcome you on all of this panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Actually, a couple of letters. Vita writes, yes, Trump's base forced the passage of this bill, but they wanted to see the list only because they believe it consists primarily of Democrats. If only the files about Democrats are released, the base will be happy and the conversation will shift to those horrible Democrats. The question is, where else is this information stored? I think it's those sources we can hope will come forward. Then we go to this letter from Don. Trump has directed the DOJ/Bondi to concentrate on investigating Epstein's relationships with Democrats. I have to point out that Trump himself was a registered Democrat while most of this was going on.
That's very clever.
Good legal point there. I don't understand this letter, so I'm not going to read it. Okay. Maybe if I spend some more time with it, I'll figure it out. But okay, let's go to other topics this morning. I want to talk about, we'll get to healthcare after the break. We'll talk about that. Before we do that, however, we have a few moments to talk about the new attacks on Jerome Powell. They went away for a while, and now they're back. And the president has renewed his attacks Wednesday against Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell, saying he would, quote, love to fire his ass, unquote, for not lowering interest rates as much as he would like. Speaking at a U.S.-Saudi Arabia investment forum, Trump touted mortgage rates being down despite the Fed, then went on a rant against Powell, whom he criticized and has been criticizing for months. I'll be honest, I'd love to fire him. He should be fired. Guy's grossly incompetent, Trump said to some laughter in the crowd. Since taking office, Trump has repeatedly flirted with the idea of firing Powell, but denied that he is doing so. On Wednesday, he seemed to pressure Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent to somehow persuade Powell to lower interest rates further or be fired himself. Meanwhile, Bessent, I think, as we talked about on yesterday's show, is working on the cost of rising beef prices by trying to keep immigrants from bringing in sick cows. Mm.
Yeah,
I wish
over the border.
I was making that up.
You know, I can't tell you how many times I've wished for someone to address that issue.
The sick cow in immigration. Yeah.
That it's screwing everything up.
It's truly
one of the real keys to the United States' success as a country and its wealth is the perception that we've carefully cultivated that we have an honest financial system, that our banks do their jobs, and that the Federal Reserve does its job. Yeah. And in order for it to do its job, it has to be independent. Oh, and the stock market has to be fair and honestly managed. You know, like that's why we have such strict laws against insider trading. So when we start breaking down the credibility of those institutions, when you start interfering with them, when you start introducing political interference, you are weakening the financial structures that are crucial to this country's success. This is the kind of behavior, well, I mean, I don't want to exaggerate it because he hasn't actually fired the guy yet. And presidents have, there's a long history of presidents kind of jawboning the Fed, trying to get the Fed to do something and the Fed resisting. That's sort of part of the game that's played. And so for the time being, maybe we should interpret this as just Trump's version of that game. But if he succeeds, if he does remove Powell, if the Fed does bend the knee and adjust rates in the way that the president wants, it's going to hurt the economy in the long term. And it's not just going to hurt the economy by, you know, maybe overheating it or whatever, but it's going to hurt the credibility of our financial system. And so many of our institutions' credibility have already been damaged, and this is one more that's now kind of in trouble.
Oh, Bill, you're very right about all of that. The problem is that he either doesn't know that or doesn't care, probably both. He definitely doesn't care. He's not going to, you know, be around to see the consequences. His, you know, inner circle isn't going to see the consequences. He wants things to be done the way he wants them to be done. Doesn't actually care about the effects on the American people, but will still present it as though he is doing this for the American people. And regrettably, a good proportion of the American people will eat it up.
I mean, there's a tension between, like, that's the thing that the Fed is trying to balance between not letting inflation get out of control, which is bad for consumers, but not letting unemployment get too high. Like, that's the fundamental balance they try to strike.
I realize. Go ahead.
And interestingly, I think the Fed is trying to smooth out or stabilize the economy in reaction to the things, the economic decisions that he's doing, tariffs, to that are destabilizing the economy. So they're trying to help him, and he is trying to drive them out, or at least play the refs, essentially, to get force them to lower interest rates, which may or may not be the right thing to do. But this mirrors what we've been talking about for the previous segment, which is the way that he's destabilizing the justice system and the Justice Department through gutting the agency, pardoning the January 6th folks, a whole range of things and misuse and misstatements. He's doing the same, trying to do the same thing to the economic system. I think one of the differences held him back is in this case, there are fire breaks. There are key business leaders who understand and are trying to, as is reported, convey to him how deeply economically destabilizing it would be if he fires the Fed chair. And I think that's the only thing. I do think he's well aware. He's been told repeatedly, but he continues to push at this in a dangerous way to our a way that's dangerous to our economic stability, to the stability of the dollar.
Mm-hmm.
I kept on seeing this story last night on Powell and Trump, and they had a picture of the two men together. And
at the building.
And just my initial reaction was, I said to myself, how old is Jerome Powell? He is 7 years younger than the president, which surprised me.
Yeah.
I don't know why that fascinated me, but I'll just throw it out there.
And the other thing is that he was appointed by Trump. Like he,
right. Yeah. Yeah. There's
in his previous
that
term,
too.
Like this is the guy he put in charge.
Yeah.
And now
right.
Couldn't be the worst man for the job.
He's disrupting our economic systems. Paul's trying to save him and he's still using him, you know, as a distraction. And It's look what he did to his own businesses, right?
Yeah.
He's doing that to the country.
We are going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We will get to many other issues. We welcome you. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. We will be back after this break and news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back. It is easier. You're
We're not
right.
going to discuss
it,
that.
You're right. It That's is. It's much, much easier to do that. All kinds of topics we bring up during the break, and it's fascinating. We're talking about the former president of France, Nicolas Sarkozy, who is was sent to jail for 5 years and now is out already. Let me go to other stories here in our time together. Bill Hammond is here, Emily Honan, and Teresa Bourgeois, and we welcome all of you. Thank you very much for joining us. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. The Trump and House and Senate Republican talking points seem to be send money directly to patient non-insurance companies. This is a discussion about the next step on the Affordable Care Act after the shutdown. Teresa touched on this earlier in our discussion today, but where are we? And President Trump is advocating for direct health care payments and is slamming insurance company. President Trump said on Tuesday, amid rising health care premiums, he would only consider approving legislation that provides a pathway for direct health care payments. And there was an article, I believe, in the New York Times earlier this week with a headline that said Republicans are desperate for a health care plan. They simply don't have one. And I thought that was an interesting.
Right. I wanted to talk about this mostly because I want to hear from Bill, because it seems that we are weeks away from millions and millions of Americans losing their health care coverage that are now covered through the Affordable Care Act, because the subsidies that were put in place during COVID are set to expire and the Republicans are choosing not to renew them. They say it's because they were scheduled to expire. Well, I think in the funding bill that they passed last summer, all of the health care provisions there are time limited as well. So do they anticipate they're not going to renew those? But the bigger question immediately now is that Trump's talking points and the Republican talking points seem to be, let's give the money instead of giving it to the insurance companies, let's give it directly to the people so they can spend it the way they want. To me, that's just throwing out empty words. But Bill, I wondered what you wanted to say.
It's kind of sad that the debate is being broached this way, because the idea behind this, the fundamental concept of giving people more control over their own health care resources, there's merit to that. It's not a crazy idea. I think it is true that in this case the president is glomming on to serious work that's been done by think tanks and analysts and commentators. I will say it's not an idea that's gotten a lot of traction. But I do think that it's not crazy. I think, for example, when we hand out, when we provide people support to buy food, we give them the money. It's in the form of SNAP benefits. They choose what food to buy. They choose what stores to use it in. This is a variation of that same concept. Instead of instead of handing them an insurance policy, you give them the resources, and they use those resources either to buy insurance or to directly purchase health care. We, for some reason in this country, and through a series of historical accidents, we call it insurance, but insurance is usually to pay for unexpected events, catastrophic events. You don't use car insurance to buy new tires. We use health insurance to cover everything, the routine, the expected, the minor, and the catastrophic. And if we could, it'd be very difficult, but if we could move away from that model, if people exercise their power as a consumer more directly with the providers, I think that would improve our healthcare system. The trouble is we've gotten accustomed to the system the way it is, and moving away from it would be very difficult. I don't think like the idea that's being floated now by the president seems very half-baked, and the idea that we could come up with a plan between now and December 31 is unrealistic. But the underlying idea, I think, deserves at least some consideration.
So, but I have questions and thoughts about this. My concern is that the open enrollment ends January 15th, right, for the ACA. They need to enroll now. And these Republicans are talking as if, oh, well, we have to the end of December. They don't. You know, time's up, folks. You don't have to the end of December. Yes. You don't have a plan. You don't have an alternative. And right now, if you put the money into health savings accounts and then go out on the market and try to buy something, and if you repeal without replacing, if you repeal the structure, or you have the Affordable Care Act infrastructure cave in on itself because of all the changes that the Trump administration is making to it to try to force it to cave in on itself, then you can have all the money you want in your health savings account. But if you have a pre-existing condition, you know, we're going to go back 15 years. If you have a pre-existing condition and you can't get health insurance that covers people with a pre-existing condition, that's not going to help you, right? And the Democrats for months kept saying, let's negotiate, let's discuss, because they too agree that there should be some changes, some improvements. And when they were debating the rule on to end the shutdown, there was a lot of really interesting back and forth on these kinds of issues. But they haven't, for years and years and years, they've dismantled, but the Republicans can't even reach an agreement among Republicans about a replacement plan, let alone more broadly reach an agreement with Democrats. And until they do, they're caving in the system. They're trying to dismantle the system with nothing else in place. And that is going to leave people not just who are covered through the ACA, but more broadly, it's going to raise everybody's rates. It's going to affect hospitals. It's going to affect particularly rural hospitals. It's going to cause damage to the system, I think. You're the expert, not me.
Those tax credit, the enhanced tax credits, are going to expire unless something is done to change that.
And that will impact not just them.
It affects 6% of the population are benefiting from those enhanced tax.
But it will have a ripple effect because of the number of uninsured, right?
It could have a ripple effect. I mean, to be clear, these enhanced tax credits didn't exist until 2021. So they were an add-on to the Affordable Care Act. If they expire, we'll be going back to the original design of the Affordable Care Act.
I think the issue is that we a lot of people like to pretend that we've recovered from 2020 when we really haven't, and things have kind of gotten worse. And bringing it back to what we had before then is just not, it's not going to be enough anymore. It's not going to be nearly enough. And, you know, as Teresa was saying, they don't have a plan. They don't like this one for whatever reason, but they don't have a plan in place because they're incompetent. They don't know how to do it.
Now, one thing they did seem to have agreement on was this PBM's agreement that there could reach agreement is the prescription benefit managers, which I think you've talked about before, these middle people.
Pharmacy
benefit managers. So there are areas where if they would sit down and negotiate, they could find agreement. But isn't it about 24 million people who are going to lose their insurance? Isn't that what the analysis says?
So some of them will lose insurance, not all of them. It's a question of, like, it's very complicated. These enhanced subsidies affect different people at different levels. Some people do face a really dramatic increase in their costs. So, like, if you're a family just above 400% of poverty, and so, like, for a family of four, that's $160,000 is about 500% of poverty. It's pretty substantial income you have. The typical family in that situation has access to employer-sponsored insurance. But if they don't, they face the possibility of having to pay the entire premium. Family of four in New York, it's about $26,000. The enhanced premium, right now they're getting a 50% discount. Like, you know, the tax credits are covering half their premium. That's an unusual situation for a family of four, $160,000 of income, needing to buy insurance through the exchange. Not a lot of people are in that position. But if you are in that position, these enhanced tax credits have been very valuable, and they're going away. Whether that family will decide, okay, we just can't have insurance, that's some will probably make that decision and others will not. So it will have a ripple effect in the sense that there will be an uptick in the uninsured rate. Before these tax credits existed, the uninsured rate in New York specifically was quite low. The enhanced tax credits haven't had that much effect in New York. But nationwide, there are states like Florida, apparently a fifth of the state is buying their insurance to the exchange. That surprised me. It will have a huge effect in Florida. It will have a bigger effect in the states that didn't do the Medicaid expansion.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me. I mean, oddly enough, New York is a very safe state. It's a state that has a lot of, like, social benefit programs, a lot of grants, a lot of things that you know, for all its flaws, New York is a safe state to be living in right now. It's a very, very expensive state because of that. And I think that's what's kind of at the core of everything. I mean, to me, a family of four living on $160,000 in New York, that sounds like barely scraping by at the amount that things cost right now, the cost of living, and all these other unexpected expenses. Everything is just getting more expensive. And if you stay at $160,000 or you get a nice raise of $162,000, it doesn't go far. You're not able to save a lot. And one catastrophic event, let alone two, could just completely tank everything. If someone gets very sick, if someone gets in a car accident. And that's the kinds of things that insurance is supposed to protect against, but that's not how it works in practice, or it's not how it's going to work.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up the show. We'll hear, hopefully get one more topic in, and here are the final views from our panelists this morning. We welcome you as well. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org, last call for letters. And we'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Just a couple letters before we go to another topic. Andrew says, we tried the conservative health care option with ACA. Republicans destroyed it. The only viable options now are universal health care or massive dysfunction and resulting deaths and impoverishment. That from Andrew. Then we check in with Eddie. Every time someone mentions the ACA extensions being terminated at the end of the year, please mention that the tax cut extensions are going to continue for corporations and the wealthy. Then we go to this. John said tax breaks for the rich were set to expire, too. That didn't stop them from extending them. A similar point to the earlier letter. That from John. All right, let's move on. We welcome you.
Can I just...
Yes, of course.
I want to beg to differ with one of the letter writers. The ACA did not get destroyed. I mean, that's one of the kind of the hidden understories here is the ACA has proven to be indestructible. Like, the Republicans keep, they wanted to repeal it during Trump's first term. They failed. It's still going. It got bigger during Biden's term. This, the expiration of the enhanced tax credits is like a shrinkage of the ACA structure, but the underlying structure is still there and it's going strong and it's influencing our healthcare in a myriad ways. Like, millions of people have insurance through the ACA and they will continue having insurance next year. It's that, like, that the idea that it's like just blown up and gone away, that's not how it's working at all.
It is still strong, and they have tried more than 70 times, 70 different votes to try to repeal it with nothing to replace it. But their approach now is to try to make a whole series of changes administratively and through this legislation that many worry that it will have the impact of weakening it.
That is the nature of, if we had a national healthcare system, we would be having this fight. Like, if we had, like, what in England, it's a constant source of political battle, is how much money to give to the NHS, how to redesign benefits, how many people it should employ. It's a constant source of discussion. That's what, like, that's our equivalent in the U.S. is the ACA. The idea that if we switch to a national health system, all of these fights go away, that's not the case.
I agree with you on that, but. Also, if the Republicans would come to the table with the Democrats and try to work out some agreement on improvements to these programs, that would go a long way to both finding some savings and improving the delivery of care. And it needs to be constantly fine-tuned, and they're not doing their job coming to the table and trying to do that, is my concern.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of like saying if Republicans weren't Republicans and Democrats weren't Democrats. I mean, right now, they are polarized and they can't agree on stuff across manner of issues.
There could be some areas of agreements, and the public needs that.
But
and there needs
meantime,
to be a way to force them to the table.
In the meantime, if you look at just the dollars going, there is nothing the federal government spends more on than health care.
Right.
And it gets bigger every year. Like, it's not like it's slowing down or getting smaller. It's, we spend more on healthcare year after year after year, in spite of all of these efforts that they're, you know, what the Republicans are doing. If they may be intended to slow down spending on healthcare, but it's not work. Like, it's not dramatically changing the trajectory of healthcare spending.
But as you've talked about before, you can spend not just more, but you should be able to spend better, spend differently. There are ways to make changes in the system that both are cost-containing and better for the consumer. And that work is not getting done. That's what bothers me.
One more topic, and we'll call it a morning. The Social Security Administration has abandoned plans to block thousands of older Americans from qualifying for disability benefits after an uproar that reached senior officials in the Trump White House, according to people familiar with the decision. The agency is also halting a plan to use modern labor market data to help judge whether disability claimants can work, a project that has cost the federal government more than $350 million so far. The new data would have replaced a long outdated jobs database that until recently included obsolete occupations such as nut sorters and telephone quotation clerks.
Somebody's got to sort the nuts.
That's right. How do you know? You know, it's they call it mixed nuts, but you can
Somebody's got to mix the nuts.
Yeah, that's
yeah, but
right.
That's a diversity. Like, is that a diversity thing? Right?
Well, that's
so
a very, very good point.
Sorry, she said cynically.
Yes, that's a very good point. And you nut allergies, and it's all bad. The policy affecting older people would have fundamentally altered who qualifies for the two federal disability programs. By eliminating a person's age as a factor to consider, it fulfilled a long-held damn you, MS Now, who had pop-up ad came on and took away my story.
Oh, no.
Well, we know the gist of it.
Yes. What do you think?
Well, I think that this is at least a victory I see. I kind of think that I don't really like making a list of jobs that we think that disabled people can or cannot do. You can't categorize people like that. There's so many different kinds of disabilities. And I think that anything that toys with taking disability benefits away, especially from older people, is just such a sign of hubris to me, because we're all going to be old and disabled one day. So even if you think it's not going to affect you now, it is going to affect you eventually. And it just seems extremely, it's the most short-sighted of everything.
The opposition mounted following an article in the Washington Post in October that reported the new policy, that it could result in a loss of future benefits for hundreds of thousands of people. Phil.
This seemed to me like... I don't pretend to understand all the ins and outs of it, but it seemed to me this is like the kind of normal policy debate that we should have and we used to have and we've always had.
It's very refreshing.
Well, I don't want to say that, but like it's a complicated thing. You know, you've got a system. It's very expensive. It provides benefits for people based on the fact that they're disabled. It's on top of the benefit you get just for being old and retired, right? Basic Social Security. There's this additional benefit you can get when you're not old and retired if you're disabled. And how do you define who qualifies for that? It's a complicated thing. How do you define who's disabled? How do you prevent fraud? How do you prevent abuse? And so the federal government has these elaborate rules. One part of the elaborate rules is a list of jobs. And they sort of say, well, if you could do this job, then you're not disabled. It's a clunky, awkward, but that's bureaucracy, folks. That's what bureaucracy looks like. And you need to update that list of jobs. Somebody was trying to do that. It caused an uproar. Like, they backed off. That's how government functions, for better or for worse.
Well,
30 seconds. Go ahead.
The thing is, I'm not sure if this went through the normal processes that had happened pre-Trump. And you see across government, whether it's in healthcare or the dismantling of education or the changing of the rules in water quality or the opening up of lands or whatever, these things are being done without following the typical processes so that there's broad input. And that's where I would wonder and worry about, did it have the proper scrutiny that it requires? Because this is, I think, you know, the kind of, I don't know if this one in particular is a Russell vote, but this Project 2025, get everybody, drive everybody you can off of Medicaid, drive everybody you can off of SNAP, drive everybody you can off of these various programs. At the same time, you're giving tax breaks to the wealthiest.
We are out of time. My thanks to all of you. You're wonderful. We'll be right back.